Hitler by Wyndham Lewis. We did part one. Part two is called Adolf Hitler, the Man and the Party. We did that. Now we're doing part three, Race and Class, and they're in quotes. And the three sections are called Many Class Wars, The Art of Being Ruled, and One Advantage in Race Notion. So, Race and Class, Many Class Wars, starting page 69. This is part, subset one. In their program, the National Socialists catalog our chaos. It is, quote, a picture of a battle of all against all, unquote. The revelation of St. John the Divine does not provide a more chaotic scene of dreamlike universal conflict than what we now witness all about us everywhere in the world. This carefully planned system of conflicts, of class wars, is plotted like the checkerboard patches of a garden designed to represent a wilderness of misspent human ingenuity. These wars are forever simmering. And wars is in quotes. These wars are forever simmering. As we have seen in the case of the political life of Germany, a savage ferment prevails above the muffled roar of which pistol shots ring out, and daily the dead and wounded are carried away to morgue or hospital. It does not require phenomenal foresight to discern that at any moment this universal unrest could be made to swell up suddenly into a world storm of unparalleled proportions, a war to end class war, as it were. And that's in italics. I mean in quotation marks. A war to end class war, as it were. And the more classes that are contrived, the more likelihood of some ultimate civil Armageddon to abolish them. And classes was in quotes. The class, so everywhere where he says class war, he puts it in quotes, it seems. The class war was an excellent notion. That's a singular class war. The class war was an excellent notion. Its applications are far wider than are generally supposed, for there is scarcely anything in the world that you cannot make into a class, class italicized. And wherever you have a class, there you can have a war. As the NASDAQ program describes it, so the Nazi program, National Socialist, says, the picture of a fight of all against all, government against people, party against party, thereby resulting in the strangest and most impossible alliances, parliament against government, employee against employer, consumer against producer, trader against producer and consumer, landlord against householder, workman against peasant, official against public, working class against bourgeoisie, church against state. End of quote from the pamphlet. And all this fine work, they exclaim, is the handiwork of our little friend Marx, Karl Marx, and is kept alive and further developed at the cost of uncounted outpourings of money for the agitator's salary to finance political strikes and so forth. This is the business of the Marxists, as the German calls them. We will not argue here the pros and cons of Marxism. All revolutions are means to ends. Experience tells us that the ends are usually not found to justify the means. It is a matter of opinion. But what we can do, neglecting the theoretic ends at which the Marxist aims, is to amplify a little the civic picture of catastrophic disintegration, catastrophic in quotes. Everyone is at all events aware of the existence of these interlocking chains and concatenations of domestic wars between often quite imaginary or artificial classes. Many of these minor or major class wars have their newspaper name. Thus, everybody is quite familiar with the term sex war. And a very bad war that can be when some poor uneducated couple are stirred up by newspaper slogans and provocative sex warlike propaganda and fall upon each other. A war of attrition begins, a trench warfare with beds and bolsters and coal scuttles as the familiar objects of the battlefield. All the normal strife of loving couples is embittered a thousandfold. Let us take this particular class war and scrutinize it a little more closely than is generally done in, say, the Sunday Illustrated paper. Marx must step back. He cannot be held responsible for its start, at least. We find at once that the sex war is coeval with that great web of revolutionary humanitarian movements, in the early skirmishes of which Dickens, for instance, in England, played such a spirited part, and on behalf of which, over half a century later, we see Strindberg so hard at work up in Sweden, but in his case upon the other side. This particular war started before Marx's time. It was before he produced his evil formula, class war. As a movement of humanitarian liberation, these wars of brother against brother at first were not necessarily evil, though conducted at times with a farcical silliness. Also, they were domestic disputes and feuds. They were the monopoly, even the secret, of the European world. The immemorial institutions of the East were not for a long while disturbed by our feverish unrest. But now the whole earth looks on with delight, hatred and scorn. Read that again. But now the whole earth looks on with delight, hatred and scorn, or actively participates in the inner readjustments of our social system. It would have been better to keep these adjustments strictly private and domestic. This broadcast and cosmic advertisement, so much gratuitous publicity for domestic issues, is reminiscent of another stupidity, namely the use of great numbers of Asiatic and African troops in the war. Stupid, that is, if you desire the good of Europe. Intelligent, if you desire its destruction. Stupid and intelligent were italicized. I am not so much arguing here that the European civilization ought not to end, as merely pointing out how that destruction is being brought about. It is a subject of constant speculation how the Roman Empire came to collapse. Some say Christianity, others say mosquitoes. There is no mystery at all. It is an open conspiracy, in quotes, open conspiracy, about the fall of Europe. In a word, it is the result, in the first instance, of an enormous new factor, machinery and industrial technique. In the short space of a century, science turned our world upside down. Secondly, the world being upside down and inside out, the shrewd parasite, existing in all times and places, psychologically an outcast as regards our settled structure, took advantage of this disorder and consequent bafflement to sting us all to death. Of course, historians in the future will assert that it was influenza or the pranks of the last Roman Kaiser, but we know better. To return to the good old class wars by which we are beset, many beyond question originated in bad abuses, or else were the logical outcome of a regrouping necessitated by the conditions of the industrial age. For instance, a really intellectual woman, was surely right to free herself from a stupid and overbearing husband. Surely there was nothing against her possessing a separate estate. If instead of bearing children, she preferred to run a shop or factory, why not? And so forth. Child labor in the mills was a monstrosity because it produced monsters and because the mill owners who took it for granted were monsters. Has there ever been a human society free of great abuses deserving upheavals? And the industrial age did shake our society like an earthquake. It loosened its structure. And as it imposed upon everybody new conditions of life, it set up a natural conflict between those with imagination and spare energy who wanted to go quick and those who resented the new and wanted to go slow or not at all. So it is not any too easy to discuss, without misunderstanding, the policy of these civil wars. So it's not any too easy to discuss, without misunderstanding, the policy of these civil wars or class wars which honeycomb our Western democratic communities today. This ferment did good till it got into the hands of the crook. He always seizes upon a weak and inflamed spot in a society to do some mischief and extract some loot. The Geldmensch and his satellite, the Agitator, were soon on the job. They organized these masses of people in disequilibrium, displaced and uprooted as a consequence of the Industrial Revolution. They organized them into classes. There was nothing they did not fake up into a class. And they manufactured and stuck upon each class they had isolated and organized a label or a ticket. They might have been cattle. These labels were usually good or bad labels. They took with them stern reproof or saponaceous. These labels were usually good or bad labels. They took with them stern reproof or saponaceous flattery. The Geldmensch and the Agitator are always strongly moralistic in their outlook. They are very fervent. They find that it invariably pays to have a sickly moral huskiness in the throat. The rankest sob stuff is worth its weight in banknotes, given the psychological moment. Well, there it was. They found they could traffic endlessly in these animosities. Divide et impera, or divide et impera, is the best trade device, as well as political, and a roaring trade was done beyond question. When two nations fall out, the armament king and chemical king rake in the shekels. When two men fall out, the lawyer coins money. When two classes fall out, it is the same thing. Power or wealth passes from both to some third class. The Versailles treaty makers must have known that the more nations you make or break the world up into, the more jolly old profitable disputes you prepare the pickings for the outsider. Do that again. The Versailles treaty makers must have known that the more nations you make or break the world up into, the more jolly old profitable disputes you prepare, the more pickings for the outsider. Who gains? Always some Mr. X, the third party, the outsider. England, as an island power, was the outsider or the third party for some time. She sold munitions to foreign nations at war. But today it is no nation, of course, since capital is international. Then the manufacture of endless class wars was both profitable, destructive, and awfully amusing. It had amusement value. It had news value. It was good business. It has been the only visible means of support of millions of men for many, many years now. And they have waxed fat upon it. Some come to see me to ask me to have a slap at some class or other they are fixing up. And they can scarcely get in at my modest door. But the class combatants, though they may start full of honorable motives and be excited to action by some fantastic injustice, end up under these conditions in a more and more squalid, long-drawn-out, poison gas campaign. And at the end, there they are. Both will inevitably be bankrupt of energy. Both are defeated, knocked out by the third party, the honorable Mr. X or Lord and his provocative agents. But people are taught nothing about all this at school. They would be very difficult to manage if they knew all this. And I agree that they ought to know nothing. And of course, there is this to be said. If you told it to them in a take-it-or-leave-it, non-religious, democratic manner, they would not understand it. And if they understood, they would not believe. I am not saying that guild men should not profit by this human helplessness. I'm just pointing out to you, if you have eyes to see how it all happens, and I am explaining for what it is worth that there is a large and powerful party in Germany who see it too, more or less, and who identify themselves for some reason with the helpless herds and who have a most terrible down on the Geldmensch, as they call them. I'm going to read that last part. I'm not saying the Geldmensch should not profit by this human helplessness. I'm just pointing out to you, if you have eyes to see, how it all happens. And I am explaining for what it is worth that there is a large and powerful party in Germany who see it too, more or less, and who identify themselves for some reasons with the helpless herds, and who have a most terrible down on the Geldmensch, as they call him. So, that's the end of that section.
All participants are now unmuted.
Yeah, it's interesting. So class warfare was a new thing at that point? Is that why he was making a big deal out of it?
No, Marx brought in the class warfare in the
1930s. But I mean like in terms of an actual war happening. Marx predicted it, but I mean like in terms
well,
of...
Well, people would say the revolutions of the 19th century part of the class war, you know, the ones of 1830, 1848, 1870. There's a whole bunch of upheavals all over the world. But he's saying that industry and technique, where was that? The media... In a word, he says there's no mystery at all. It is an open conspiracy about the fall of Europe. And this is after World War I. In a word, it is the result in the first instance of an enormous new factor, machinery and industrial technique. He knows that the technology is just causing incredible new confusions and chaos. And so he says the simple class war of the 19th century, because of the new industrial media coming in complicating things, now there's all kinds of class wars, including the sex war and the child war, child labor war. You get that, Chad?
Yeah, there's just more divisions in terms of, like, smaller classes that are being divided up and conquered.
Right. He says that the elites are purposely doing that. It's the old Hegelian thing. You know, you have one group, then you posit another group, then you get them fighting, so the third, the synthesis, goes around the thesis and the antithesis.
So that would be like the war on terror and then having the new security infrastructure wrap around it.
Yeah. And the conspiracists call that the Hegelian pattern, and it's been around for 50 years or more. Conspiracy books write about it. That's the secret to the Illuminati that John Birchers talk about, I think, and the Alex Jones world. It's interesting that he's saying it back in 1930. Now, maybe it was, there were a lot of conspiracy books in the 20s, so maybe it was a theme too back then. As before my time, I didn't read all the books in the 20s. I was a child. And I was interested in becoming visual space that early. You know, McLuhan said that people spend a lot of their lives finding out what happened in their parents' generations. They're fascinated about what went on just before they were born. And you can say that about me, my fascination about the 20s and the vortices is me trying to find out what happened just before I was born.
Mm-hmm. So the other thing, too, is about the class war and the smaller, like, segments of the population that are being divided up into classes. And if you fast forward to like later in the 20th century, if you look at like the way that they accelerated and like hyper sped that up to where you got like American Idol or shows like that where you've got somebody up on stage and then you got like half the population voting for them and half against them.
Yeah.
And then
the
third element would be, you know, the record company or something that's going to sign the kid up on stage.
Right.
So it becomes a business process. So it goes from being a political thing in the early part of the 20th century to being just business at the end of the 20th century.
Yeah. That's where all the conspiracy literature, even LaRouche to the degree he's a conspiracist, is obsolete. There's too many environments. No one even has to bother conspiring. The population will do most of the work for you.
Mm-hmm.
That's tetrad management. You let the people run the circus.
So on your chart, is McLuhan in the triad?
Yes. He's aware of the Hegelian dyadic front.
Right.
And LaRouche is aware of the use of monotheism or the monad as a disservice. That's why it's called God in that LaRouche quadrant. So he's operating from the dyad. McLuhan operates from the triad.
Do you have Lewis in the McLuhan quadrant?
Yes, yeah.
Okay, that makes sense then, because it's like, this is Lewis's essay, and McLuhan is acting that observation out later in his writings.
Right. I was just thinking, Thompson is monad. Maybe LaRouche is dyad. No, you got one... Three,
no.
LaRouche is monad. Yeah. And so he's studying the monad and showing how it's set up by a duality, a fake duality on the oligarchic level. That's the ground. Then you would think that McLuhan is the sequence, chronological sequence. He'd be two, dyad. No, he's three. Thompson is dyad. Thompson is operating from the three level. So I had that wrong. I said McLuhan was dyad. Or, no, he's triad.
No, I asked if McLuhan was triad, and you said, yeah.
And what that means, that he's tetrad. The hidden ground, the figure is what they're not about. So LaRouche shows the hidden factor, Leibniz versus Newton, over the monad. Monad is the figure. McLuhan is looking at the Hegelian dialectic and seeing that it's obsolete because he's including the tetradic retrieval aspect. Thompson is looking at the dyad from the triad, religious triad point of view. He even said that to me, that McLuhan was just Hegel. He said that to me. And he also talked about the fourfold process being a cliche, and McLuhan just building up on that. Then you have Croker. He does the tetrad from the pentadic android meme level. And I do the pentad, in other words, analyze the android meme, from the hexadic level, which is the extension of non-physical products. But when you read it down, it's LaRouche is monad, McLuhan is not dyad, you'd think he would be, he's number two, he's triad. Then number two goes into Thompson is dyad, then four is Croker, and I'm five. Anyways, what are we doing that for, Chad? Lewis is in the McLuhan quadrant.
Well, I was just connecting the, what do you call it, Hegel? Is it Hegelian dialectic?
Yeah, yes.
With McLuhan. Lewis is writing that essay, focusing on the Hegelian dialectic. And then you've got McLuhan later, who is a later 20th century retrieval of Lewis's body.
Right. Yeah.
So I was just connecting it to your chart and how those factors play out. Yeah.
Anybody guess anything else to say?
I noticed there was a reference Lewis made to Karl Marx, and I remember I just thought the idea, I had an idea that I remember hearing McLuhan in one of the clips that you shared last year about McLuhan saying that Marxism occurred a lot long before Karl Marx actually brought it up, or something in that reference. Or communism, I'm sorry, communism, that the propagandists tried to tell to Karl Marx or Marxism that it occurred a long time ago. So I saw a link between Lewis and McLuhan, or Lewis's influence on McLuhan, because it was a reference that in which you just read about Marxism, that the class war was before.
Yeah,
was it the class? Old, yeah.
Yeah, the McLuhan says that hardware communism happened by 1830, you know, when Marx was a boy.
Yeah.
And that Marx missed the software communism of the new electric spaces and was just analyzing the hardware communism and predicting effects of it coming when it already had happened. That's why the 19th century had class war. That's the hardware communist effect. McLuhan says that the printing press brought in class war. So it goes back to 1600. So it become, so Karl Marx and them, to the degree that they're engaged in class war, they're redoing the printing press stuff. The printing press effect. That's what McLuhan says, that literacy created the classes, made rigid divisions between the natural differences in feudalism. But yes, communism, hardware communism happened long before McLuhan. I mean, Marx. And you know, back in the 60s, 70s, nobody would accept that. But now it's quite, in a way, because we're so involved with software communism, it really is, in that sense, McLuhan was ahead of his time, and now it's kind of obvious for many people of considering what McLuhan's saying because of how far
gone. What technology was it in the 19th century that caused Marx to retrieve the communist ideas of the printing press?
The kinetic machines, the trains, the coaches. McLuhan used to say that in 1830, the average man, for not too much money, could travel anywhere in the railways, the coaches, read newspaper services, information services, all that early industrial steam-powered reality, which is pumping the kinetic extension of the muscles, that turned the old visual space into an art form or a rear-view mirror.
Right, so the common man saw, oh, there's all this stuff that's moving, and we can move from the city out to the countryside, so we can mobilize, and, you know.
Right.
And they say when
all those divisions, which they didn't notice when the printing press brought in, they now can see the divisions that the printing press made and are not applicable anymore. They're obsolete. But the working man can't see the kinetic space is making him see the Gutenberg class war.
Okay, so they were rebelling against an old environment then. They were going against the printing press environment that was obsolete.
Yeah. Yeah,
that's funny. So that just repeats ad infinitum, right? Like, it's the same process. You bring in a new technology. They feel like, so the one that's obsolete, that's everywhere, like in that case, the kinetic machine.
Right.
Someone capitalizes on it politically and sets up a system where they can make everybody feel like, oh, we can now overthrow the man let's all use this new technology, like in this case, the information technology of the internet. Let's use that to overthrow the Bush administration or whatever. And then, but really, they're rebelling against an old environment that's nothing but cobwebs anymore.
That's right, Don Quixote.
Yeah.
So then the electric stuff that starts to come in, the software companies that starts coming in with the telegraph, that's when the working class really gets going. Marx is no longer just a writer. The unions are forming, the First International, the Second International, and by 1900, you know, there's a world movement of communism, or of bureaucrats ready to topple the class war using hardware to do it, the new later developments of hardware explosions, and missing what the telegraph, telephone, and software stuff was going to do. It was going to turn the chemical warfare of the chemical body was being translated into discarnate man, which was going to really cause a whole new dimension in the 20s that people didn't see coming. So all the, you could say all the many class wars, that was the beginning of the kinetic spaces and kinetic developments, which were ground in the 19th century, becoming figure in the first part of the 20th century inside the telegraph radio world.
Mm-hmm.
Like people, they were taking, you could say they were taking over the hardware services and making them available to everybody. And that was literacy. And that was obsolesced by the discarnate state.
So the whole thing, the whole evolution, progression of media development, new environments and things like that, it's like a giant pump. And it just pumps the crowd from like one side to the next, and then into the next quadrant and the next quadrant. They don't realize that they're in it, but they're just being pumped around.
That's what the big chart shows, and the tiny note develops it. You know, the two charts of this robotic, a new environment comes in, everybody starts fighting the last war,
mm-hmm.
the previous war. They're always one war behind.